Bill McKay, good morning.
Kia ora, Catherine.
Your mission is, in 14 minutes or less.
A decent whack of time this year. I think it was your New Year's resolution to give me time I deserve.
It's the curse of being last on. All the sins of the morning fall to you.
Yes. And the RMA is, I think it might be the biggest, thickest act in the country, so there's plenty in there to talk about. But I'll be talking about the spirit of it and the problem, and this will be a two-parter, because I think first we need to understand what's wrong with it, because the spirit was good, but it just is not working properly. And next time I come on, I'll talk about what it's being replaced with. So I teach this subject, but I'm also someone who, since the 1990s, has experienced it in practice, you know, getting buildings done for clients and applying for resource consents for them. But I've also done a lot of opposing developments on behalf of the community. And the RMA gets a lot of stick over the years for being time-consuming and costly and hindering progress, but some of that's a little bit unfair. Often those issues are a result of city council or district plans and rules and their processes there. But that's another subject. So the RMA came in the early 90s, 1991, with a brand new Building Act and Building Code as well. And as you mentioned, just after 11, it replaced well over 50 acts, plus a whole bunch of regulations and a whole bunch of different permit processes that you needed to go through, you know, one for land use, one for water, one for this, one for that. Replaced them all with a one-stop consent process based on sustainable management. And that sustainable management was the first time any piece of legislation was addressing that issue. And the RMA, despite what people think, is not prescriptive. It doesn't say you can do this, you can't do that. It says you can do whatever you want to do as long as you don't have a significant adverse effect on the environment. And the key word in there is significant. And all cities and districts in New Zealand have plans developed by their councils, so I think it's 88-odd or something like that. If your project that you're doing complies with a plan's activities, such as land use or size rules, location, height, that sort of thing, then you don't need a resource consent. You're away. But if it doesn't comply even a tiny little bit, and you can't adjust it to fit within the rules, then you need neighbours' approval if it's minor. And I've generally had no problems getting that when I explain it to people. But if it is bigger, then you need a resource consent. And that may or may not be publicly notified, meaning that the public can make submissions on it. And you can make submissions from anywhere that you like. So if you're in Invercargill, you can make a submission on a resource consent in Kaitaia. So your resource consent application needs plans. You've got to have those all drawn up, and an assessment of effects on the environment. And that's the key report in there. That takes a lot of time to do, a lot of extra money for consultants. I've generally written the small ones myself, but frequently you would definitely get a planner and various others to do a much bigger one. And at council fees, of course, and processing time, and at the end of all this, there's no actual guarantee that you'll get what you want, because, you know, it's assessed on the effects on the environment. So the spirit and the aim of the RMA are good, but in practice, here's a whole bunch of issues I've identified. And for any planners out there, this is very much an architect's view, and also someone in the community opposing developments. So number one, one size fits all. So this legislation and the process around RMA applications is your little addition out the back of your house in a highly urban area, or whether it's a dam in a pristine part of the South Island's Alps or something, it's the same process, although there is a significant amount of paperwork, as you'd expect. The paperwork for the Waterview Tunnel in Auckland, when you stacked it up, was taller than our local MP, and that was David Shearer at the time, and he's a pretty tall guy. The second point is consent separation. So the building consent and resource consent are two different things, and the public often don't realise that, and that they may need both. And quite frequently, you'll see a kitset shed or a cabin or a sleep out advertised as no consent needed. And that actually means slightly misleading, because it means no building consent. But depending on where you put it, in your backyard or your front yard, you may need resource consent if you're infringing a yard or something like that. Third point is consent processing. And consents are supposed to be processed in 20 working days, but even on small things, that frequently doesn't happen, because what councils can do is stop the clock, and they just ask for more information from you, and that really puts it on hold, and they can keep playing that game while they're dealing with a backload of other stuff, and that can go on for months and months. The next point is what I call inflation, and your little lean-to that you're doing out the back of the house or a garden shed, if it requires resource consent, if I need to get resource consent for a client, then I may as well go the whole hog and ask for more, load it up, in for a penny, in for a pound, if in our decimal times, if that's still a thing. So I will kind of like puff it up a little bit. I will probably add in a few more bits and pieces and all of that, because I'm going through the process. I'm paying for it, so why not? So that actually has the effect of blowing the thing up a little bit more. The next point is the process is actually adversarial. So for bigger projects, and also, you know, if you're having the effect on your neighbours, you know, casting shade on their garden or something like that. And if a fast food joint or a childcare centre is proposed in your neighbourhood, noise and traffic, they're the two big ones, is likely to upset neighbours. So what I do, if I want to oppose this, is I rile up the neighbourhood and rouse opposition, have a good rowdy public meeting, harass our elected representatives on the council, and finally, we present a big submission to the council hearing of the application. And what councils love to do, and I've seen this a few times, is to make everyone equally unhappy. So they give consent to the proposal, but with really onerous conditions, such as limiting the operating hours and that sort of thing. And that makes both the applicant and the submitters happy. So the next point is even more time and money, because off we go, both parties appealing it to the Environment Court. So at least a year later, and after spending a whole lot more money, because you need lawyers and experts to represent you in the Environment Court, you start the hearing. For me, I've been involved with a proposal in our suburb Waterview for a heliport, and we won that. BP petrol station, we lost that. Queen's Wharf with a group of other societies, which we won. Queen Elizabeth Square, which we lost. And with the Waterview Tunnel, which was a bit of a draw, really. And even that was reasonable. That was eventually fast-tracked straight to the Environment Court, because they knew it would end up there. But from the first mooting of that motorway to completion, it still occupied 15 years. So this process can have a huge effect on time. They have mediation now, but this often goes nowhere, because the process is quite adversarial. And you can see I've used that phrase, we won, we lost. Next point, coming towards the end now, but there's quite a few, is conditions and mitigation. If approved, if your proposal was approved, often there are conditions limiting size, traffic, opening hours, signage, noise, smell, etc. And these often get breached, and it's quite hard to get the council to do anything about it. Mitigation is a thing that can reduce the effect on the environment. So you say, I'm going to kind of shade your house with my big factory, but I'm going to give you $5,000 to spend on a heat pump or something like that. That's perfectly legit mitigation. For the Waterview Tunnel, we got a new school, parks, cycleways, a pedestrian bridge. But you can also buy the consent of neighbours, write them a cheque. They sign the documents approving your application, and then they just might sell up and move away and leave the problem for the next occupant. And then second to last, what I call incremental creep. If you don't like your conditions, then you just make frequent little resource consent applications. These aren't publicly notified, and they gradually add back in extra opening hours for your fast food joint. You can get that right turn that you want, more signage, you know, you can increase noise and traffic, all those sorts of things. And lastly, the big problem is the deepest pockets by the result. If you've got plenty of money, you can hire the biggest guns, you know, the experts, the lawyers. You can produce the most convincing evidence with them, and you'll most likely get what you want. You can also buy off your opponents with mitigation or threaten them with court costs that will bankrupt them, and that will scare them off as well, because court costs can be a couple of hundred thousand in the environment court, and no one's got that in their back pockets, especially law and neighbourhood societies. So I think everyone agrees that RMA has become synonymous with time and money. One side talking about it hampering progress, the other saying it doesn't actually adequately protect the environment or lead to good strategic development. And it makes my little addition out the back of my house cost a lot more extra time and money. But we still get huge developments in inappropriate places, such as arable and environmentally sensitive land. That still happens all over the country.
You see, this is where the rub's going to come, and you'll pick up on it next week. Some of these principles are diametrically opposed. And the question is, what is the best way of resolving them, and will three acts do it better than one?
Yeah, and one of the ways they're going to do this is deal with urban environments differently from more rural or environmentally sensitive areas.
Yeah, well, and that's an interesting one, because here we were with the discussion we just had late last week on Pukekohe, north of Auckland, Nelson, Tasman, Horowhenua, Central Otago, anywhere in Otago. At the same time as we need to build more houses and house more people, we are losing that precious land.
And I've got a few great examples of that that I'll wheel out next week.
Excellent. Look forward to it. 11:45 next Monday. Thanks very much. Bill Bakaya, Senior Lecturer in the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland.